How's everybody doing? So the reason I have been, I've chosen this message this morning is because, you know, everybody that you talk to that lives on the planet is struggling with the chaos that we're finding ourselves in. It's unprecedented, at least in our lifetimes. And I had a really amazing experience on Friday. I went, there was a worship and prayer gathering in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. For those of you who remember history, Gettysburg was the bloodiest battle in the Civil War, that there was a dramatic turn, and it ended up being basically the battle that ended slavery and brought freedom into the United States. Now, this is obviously years after the Revolutionary War, but the reason why we felt it was necessary to go back to Gettysburg was because that was where the root of freedom really began in this country, and things started to shift after that. So we went back there, and it was a battle. John and Cheryl Price, you know, headed it up on, and, you know, they have a bunch of contacts in Pennsylvania, as they do all over the 13 colonies. But because of COVID and all the changes that have happened, it was 1 minute it was on, 1 minute it was off. 1 minute it was in the park, 1 minute it was back in the hotel, then it was back in the park, and then it was supposed to pour. But the governor overnight changed his mind again, and we were able to have it in the hotel. So it was a battle just getting there. But I was so encouraged. There was incredible worship, prayer, declarations. And there was some people, some men there who were in government. One was in the Pennsylvania Senate. Another was a congressman who were so radically on fire for God. I was blown away. I mean, I was shocked. I knew that there was going to be a few political people there. In fact, Michelle Bachmann was there and some other people. But when I saw what these men had to say, it gave me such a hope for a shift in government. Because all you see is lies and deceptions and fear that they put on people. But there is a remnant. I'm here to tell you there is a remnant of God's people. And these people have infiltrated, in a good sense, our nation. And they are there praying and worshiping and doing the right thing before the Lord. So I just wanted to encourage you with that and continue to pray for our government like we already did. So anyway, we're in a position that like never before in this country, right? There's immense chaos going on, and there's anger, there's suffering going on, there's hurt, there's a lot of hurt. So you have to ask yourself, so what is my part in all of this? What's my call in all of this? Well, when we get to that place where we're sitting back as Christians and saying, what am I supposed to be doing in all of this? It's time for us to get back in the Word and to answer these questions that we may have. Because we want the Word of God for our answers, right? I know you all do, but sometimes you have to remind yourself in the midst of the chaos to go back to the Word of the Lord. And we have to question ourselves and find that answer in the Word, what season we're in as an individual, right? On a personal level, as a people, and as a whole nation. We have to understand where we are and what our call is in this season. So for months now, I've been reading Ezra and Nehemiah, and I just see God's impeccable timing in all of it. And I also saw that their integrity during this chaotic time it played a huge role in the outcome of their destiny and the destiny of Israel. Without even trying or asking for it, they had pagan kings pay for the building of the altar, of the temple, and of the wall around Jerusalem without even asking for it. They were trustworthy. They were loyal. They were honoring, even though they were in captivity and it was a chaotic time. So let me give you a short version of the story of what basically was going on at the time. The Jews had been in Babylonian captivity under King Nebuchadnezzar. You guys all remember King Nebuchadnezzar? It's hard to forget that name in the Bible because it's hard to pronounce. When Persia conquered Babylon, the Lord moved on King Cyrus's heart. He was the king of Persia, and had him authorize the building of the temple in Jerusalem so that the Jews who were in captivity that were living there would still be able to worship freely. Now, this was a big thing. So he allowed all the captives, whoever wanted to come back to Judah. And over 42,000 of them come back to Judah. And he allowed them to, he said, you can rebuild the temple. Now, this brings us up to the book of Ezra, because in Ezra, in the third chapter, the first thing they did was to build the altar to the Lord. The altar had to be built before the temple could be built. They built the altar first because they knew the spiritual significance of it. The altar was where sin was dealt with, right? And where the common man, if you read the Old Testament, that was where man would meet with God, right? The temple at the time was only for the priests to enter. So this was the way that man could meet with God again. The altar was a place where they could ask for forgiveness as a people. And Lord knows they needed to do that. There has to be forgiveness before there's restoration. It has to happen. We have to ask God to forgive us as a nation before we're going to see or expect to see restoration. You can have an altar without the temple, but you cannot have the temple without the altar. What does that mean? In the New Testament, Jesus tells us that we become the temple. You can't have the Spirit of God living in you without forgiveness. The forgiveness has to happen first before he enters this temple, which is why this had such huge spiritual significance. God meets men at the place of sacrifice. Even if there is no house for his name, he will meet you at the altar. And they would perform the morning and the evening sacrifices on the altar. That was their form of worship, if you read it in the Old Testament. The worship, and this still is the same today, worship itself is always more important than the house that it happens in, because worship has to come from your heart. And it was no different back then. The Israelites were well aware of what the altar meant because they were aware of the power of blood sacrifice. It was written in the law and it was taught to them, right? The blood brought the forgiveness, the restoration, the protection. And we see this in Jesus in the New Testament, but they were taught this. They knew the significance of what the altar was. The ruined Jerusalem, remember that Jerusalem was not restored yet. It was a mess. That ruined Jerusalem was better guarded by that altar than if the walls had already been rebuilt. And they knew this. They knew the altar was more important than anything. And building this altar, you have to understand, building this altar was no easy feat. When the Israelites, while they were allowed to come back to Jerusalem, it's currently inhabited by their enemies. So this took a lot of courage to do. This wasn't, okay, we're good now. Let's go back to Jerusalem and build the altar. They had constant enemies screaming, yelling, putting them in fear. And I'm going to read that to you in Ezra chapter 3, verse 3. Despite their fear of the peoples around them, they built the altar on its foundation and sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and the evening sacrifices. They consciously made a decision to build that altar in spite of their fear. Now, why did they do that? Because they realized spiritually that it was more important to build that altar than to build the temple. It had to happen first. The very thing that led the Israelites into captivity was letting the fire go out on the altar of God because they started worshiping other gods. Now, I'm not going to read all that, but they let the fire go out on the altar and started worshiping elsewhere. That's what got them in trouble in the first place. So without the fire on the altar, there's no presence of God, right? Without the presence of God, there is no power. Their power wasn't coming from them, and they knew it. They knew that their power was coming from God. They finally figured that out. God wasn't looking for a building. God was looking for a relationship. He's looking for a relationship, and relationship happens at the altar. So this was pretty important. Their worship, their sacrifices, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles there. It was more important than any building ever was to the Lord. And I think if there's one thing that we've learned during this pandemic is that God isn't interested in our buildings, is he? He's interested in our hearts. We all had to learn the hard way about this, right? So let's go to the next scene. The Israelites begin building the temple, and then their enemies freak out. So now the altar is built. They're making the sacrifices. They're doing what God told them to do. They're worshiping in the way that they were instructed to in the Old Testament. So now they want to build the temple. And I'm going to read Ezra chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Their enemies didn't want the kingdom of the God of Israel to advance. It was clear. So the officials write a letter to the king so they can stop the Israelites from rebuilding the temple, claiming that they were the troublemakers, the ones who were actually building up the land, right? Building up the city. So the king orders them to stop. The officials of the day made up lies about the Israelites, saying that they were being disruptive and causing problems, when in fact, that's what they were doing. They were trying to put a fear on the people of Israel so they wouldn't have a place to worship. They actually bribed government officials to work against what we would call the Christians. Sound familiar? Now, listen to what happens here. Again, I'm telling you this as a story so then we could get to the point, so that you understand what's going on here. A few years later, Haggai and Zechariah, they were prophets of the day, they prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem, and they were really encouraged. They prophesied about building the temple, and the Israelites had gotten so encouraged, and they realized we really shouldn't be living in fear like this, because they stopped building it. As soon as they got that fear and that intimidation on them, like we see going on today, they stopped. So they started rebuilding the temple. Same thing happens, though. They start rebuilding. The enemies try to stop them, again, by sending a letter to the king demanding that they stop. It was nonstop. Now, King Artaxerxes, these names are unbelievable, had said no building in the past, right? But now King Darius, his son, is the king, right? His son is in charge. The Israelites told the governors that were demanding that they stop building, tell you governors, you tell King Darius that years ago, King Cyrus made a decree to us, the Israelites, that we could come back to Jerusalem and start building the temple, and that we can have all our sacred articles back that go in the temple. And please tell him to check the royal archives to see that what we're saying is true. Long story short, King Darius finds out that this is all true, and he allows the Israelites to continue building the temple. He even provided them, as per the decree from Cyrus, with all the finances to do it. He paid for whatever they needed through the royal treasury and said that if anyone gave them any trouble, a beam would be taken from their house and they would be impaled on it. That's Ezra chapter 6. Yeah, that's what the word of God says. It's just, some of this stuff is just crazy. So it's really interesting, though. So that's what's going on up till Ezra chapter 6. Please just give me, you know, bear with me with this history. But between, I found something that I never knew before. Maybe you guys knew, and I'm just, for lack of a better term in Italian, it's called stunad. Maybe I just didn't get it. Between Ezra chapter 6 and chapter 7 is where the story of Esther takes place. Remember Esther? Yeah. King Xerxes chooses Esther for his wife and afterwards almost gets fooled into annihilating the Jews from a decree that his right-hand man, Haman, had set up. Remember the story? Mordecai talks to Esther, who has been chosen to be his queen, and she saves the day by exposing Haman's plan, right? And every Jew was spared. I'm giving you the real short condensed version of this, because Esther exposed the plan of the enemy. So King Xerxes, this is Esther's husband, is the son of King Darius, the one who paid for the building of the temple. You with me so far? Now, he has apparently two kids with Esther. And we're going to talk about one of them now. And they name him Artaxerxes, after Xerxes' grandfather. Okay? Now, history tells us that the oldest son, Xerxes and Esther's oldest son, who's named Darius after Xerxes' father, he's supposed to be heir to the throne. But what I read historically, that he was killed. And that's why Artaxerxes, the younger son of Esther and Xerxes, becomes king. He takes the throne. Now, so at this time, while Artaxerxes Jr. is on the throne of the Persian Empire, Ezra makes a journey and comes back to Jerusalem with the musicians, with the Levites, the gatekeepers, the priests. And Artaxerxes Jr., son of Esther, apparently has heard of Ezra and what a knowledgeable priest he is. He's a teacher of the law. He's a scribe. He's a brilliant scholar. And he writes him a letter. And it's in Ezra chapter 7. Ezra is walking in incredible integrity in spite of the captivity. He's in Babylonian captivity, just like the rest of them are, but he's walking in such integrity that King Artaxerxes Jr., Esther's son, finds out about this man. We don't know if Esther might have said something to him, but he literally knows that this man has got incredible integrity. And I just kept thinking, man, it always goes back to your walk. How you walk is what people notice. And he lets all the governors of the Trans-Euphrates know that Ezra has the authority, now that he knows he's coming back, to do all he needs to do, and they can't impose taxes on the Levites, the musicians, the priests, and anyone else who works in the house of God. And by the way, he makes Ezra the governor of Judea. And Artaxerxes gives Ezra full power of the governorship. And he even said to him, you can tax the people if you want. You have that much authority. You can tax, even though the other governors were told not to. You have to read this as a story and figure out what's going on here. So needless to say, the other governors were really not happy with the Israelites. What caused Artaxerxes to give so much power and wealth to Ezra, who in turn would lead the people of Israel back into worship to the one true God? Well, like I said, if you follow history, Artaxerxes' mom was who? Queen Esther. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall listening to Esther explaining to him, to her young son maybe, when he was little, how all the Jews were almost murdered and how everything that happened. Like, think about these conversations, how she was an orphan and an exile, and his dad chose her to be queen, and his great uncle Mordecai spoke into her and said, you got to tell your husband, the king, about what's going on, the plan to kill the Jews. And I don't have a doubt in my mind that she must have explained to him how the God of Israel delivered them, and how even though they were in exile, he saved them from the enemy. He saved them from a mass genocide. And I'm sure she had told him how important it was to be bold and do what's right in God's eyes, even in spite of all the naysayers. What I believe is that Artaxerxes had a lot of Jewish blood running through his veins from his mother. She was Jewish. And swimming in his DNA was the inheritance of blessing of 1,000 generations. And history tells us that King Xerxes, his father, was killed when Artaxerxes was only about 11 years old. Which means he became king at 11 years old. So at 11 years old, his God-fearing, deliverer, tough Jewish mother, Esther, starts speaking life into him. There's no other explanation. I read a book on Artaxerxes. It's a historical book, not a Christian book, but it was really like you could fall asleep reading this book in 5 minutes, but I really wanted to get the history down because, you know, you got to be careful what you read on the internet. Not all of it is true. If you read some of the stuff that they say is out there about Mordecai and Esther, it's like, oh my God, these people are nuts. But anyway, so I really wanted to get the historical background. But I'm willing to bet the bank that something must have leapt inside of King Artaxerxes when he found out that Ezra was making his way back to Jerusalem. Who knows? Like I said, maybe his mom gave him the news. We don't know. But it's a pretty good bet that she must have spoken into his life when he was 11 years old. Remember, this is a pagan king ruling a huge pagan territory. There was probably about 127 provinces, if I read it right. But he has a bend toward the God of Israel because it's in his DNA. We talked last week about generational blessings when Jeremy and Paula presented Micah. This stuff is real. Now, let me read the instruction to you. This is in Ezra chapter 7, verses 11 through 28. This is a copy of the letter King Artaxerxes had given to Ezra the priest, a teacher of the law, a man learned in matters concerning the commands and decrees of the Lord for Israel. Now, this is Artaxerxes writing this. Artaxerxes, king of kings. You kind of know right there that he's not what we would call a believer the way we know him because he's calling himself king of kings. To Ezra the priest, teacher of the law of the God of heaven. He acknowledges God is the God of heaven. Greetings. Now I decree that any of the Israelites in my kingdom, including priests and Levites who volunteer to go to Jerusalem with you, may go. You are sent by the king and his 7 advisors to inquire about Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in your hand. Moreover, you are able to take with you the silver and gold that the king and his advisors have freely given to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. Together with all the silver and gold you may obtain from the province of Babylon. In other words, take what you want from my kingdom. As well as the freewill offerings of the people and priests for the temple of their God in Jerusalem. With this money, be sure to buy bulls, rams, and male lambs together with their grain offerings and drink offerings and sacrifice them on the altar of the temple of your God in Jerusalem. He's telling Ezra, make sure you do the sacrifices on the altar that your God told you. How did this king know about drink offerings and sacrifices that had to be made and the animals that had to be used? Had it not been for his mother teaching him this? The more you read this, the more you realize that she had a huge influence on him. You and your fellow Israelites may do whatever seems best with the rest of the silver and gold. Wouldn't you love somebody to tell you that? In accordance with the will of your God. Deliver to the God of Jerusalem all the articles entrusted to you for worship in the temple of your God, and anything else needed for the temple of your God that you are responsible to supply, you may provide from the royal treasury. In other words, take all you want. Now I, King Artaxerxes, decree that all the treasurers... Now, he first hit on the governors, now he's talking about the treasurers, that all the treasurers of Trans-Euphrates are to provide with diligence whatever Ezra the priest, the teacher of the law of the God of heaven, may ask of you, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine. I have no idea what that is, but I'm in. 100 baths of olive oil and salt without limit. Whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should this wrath fall on the realm of the king and his sons? This is a smart man. He knows what had happened in the past when God's wrath hit them. As a matter of fact, he saw that the Israelites were in captivity because they started worshiping God, other gods. You are also to know that you have no authority to impose taxes, tribute, or duty on any of the priests, Levites, musicians, gatekeepers, temple servants, or other workers at the house of God. And you, Ezra, in accordance with the wisdom of your God, which you possess, he's acknowledging the wisdom of God on Ezra, appoint magistrates and judges to administer justice to all the people of the Trans-Euphrates, all who know the laws of your God, and you are to teach any who do not know them. He's commanding him to teach the people of the ways of God. Whoever does not obey the law of your God and the law of the king must surely be punished by death, banishment, confiscation of property, or imprisonment. Well, at least he didn't say we're going to take a beam from their house and impale you on it. But you don't worship, you have the freedom to kill people who don't agree with what I'm telling you. And I'm not saying Ezra would have done that, but that's how much authority King Artaxerxes gave him. Praise be, and this is now Ezra talking, praise be to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, who has put it into the king's heart. He acknowledged it, to bring honor to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and who has extended his good favor to me before the king and his advisors and all the king's powerful officials, because the hand of the Lord, my God, was on me. I took courage and gathered leaders from Israel to go up with me. King Artaxerxes grabbed hold of an opportunity, his call, which he probably wasn't even aware of, truth be told, and he bought back worship into the house of God. This was not merely letting the Jews live in peace, by the way. He was reestablishing the altar of worship, a pagan king. God's favor was on Artaxerxes. He was in the line of inheritance, and it was passed on to the Jews when he showed favor to Ezra. The favor wasn't just for Ezra. When we have favor bestowed upon us from the Lord, it's to bring favor to other people, always. You see this over and over and over again in the Bible. Ezra was thrilled of what God gave him the opportunity to do, but he wasn't the final blessing, final stop for the blessing. The blessing was for the whole, all the Israelites that were there. Now, we're going to move forward to Nehemiah for the sake of time, and I'm going to summarize this. So Ezra's been in Judah, and he's teaching the ways of the laws of God to the people for years. And the Jews start living somewhat fruitfully. They're definitely living more peacefully, but they are living in captivity, but they're thriving. And I'm not going to get into detail here, but the Lord told them, thrive where you are, kind of like bloom where you're planted, like make a life for yourself and thrive, and I'll bless you here. However, as in times past, the Israelites fall back into sin and they start intermarrying with those who serve foreign gods again. And these are the descendants of the priests. So the descendants of the priests are intermarrying. Not good. Ezra reprimands them, and I'm not going to read it, and tells them to repent and get rid of the foreign wives. He said, this is an abomination before the Lord. And serving foreign gods got us into this mess to begin with. So they agree. Again, I'm summarizing. He tells it to the people of Israel. They agree. But because of that sin of the people, Jerusalem falls back into disarray, other than the temple that's there. And it's war-torn, the gates are burned down, and it's in rubble. Years pass. Now, I looked over and over again. There's a discrepancy in the number of years, but it looks like it's probably around 13 years. And Nehemiah, ironically, is now one of the highest positions in the Persian kingdom of Artaxerxes. He's the cupbearer. Now, cupbearers were highly trusted men. They were the only ones who were allowed to go into the king's presence without an invitation. Not even a queen could do that. They were highly trusted. It was one of the highest positions in the kingdom. They knew everything about the king's business. I don't know about you guys, but growing up, when I heard cupbearer, I was like, oh, that's the one who tests the wines, make sure there's no poison for the king. It was well beyond that. The cupbearer was a sought-out job. It was not a servant-type job that we think. Yes, it was serving on the king, but this was the king's most trusted person, and he was the only one. He could literally walk into the king at any time. Very interesting. And isn't it interesting how the most trusted man in the kingdom just happened to be Jewish Nehemiah? He's not a Persian, and he's second to the king. The Bible tells us that Nehemiah's brother comes back from Jerusalem and tells Nehemiah how the wall was broken down and the Jews had no protection. They had walked away from God again. And his actual words, Nehemiah's brother's words, it's a disgrace there. It's horrible. So Nehemiah is so upset. He's fast and he prays and he cries out to God, reminding God of the promises that he made to the Israelites if they would turn from their wicked ways. Nehemiah is broken over this. He's burdened to the point where the Bible tells us it's affecting his demeanor. Nehemiah actually goes into the king when he brings his wine, and the king is so used to him being such a blessing to be around. I mean, wouldn't you love that? Where somebody knows you for being a blessing, they can't wait to be around you. That's what Nehemiah was. He's normally such a blessing to be around that the king notices he's not his normal self. Artaxerxes is like, what's up with you? And he asks him what was wrong, and Nehemiah responds. He does the kind of like a Daniel expression of honor, and he says, O king, live forever, just like Daniel did with Nebuchadnezzar. He honors the king. So let's read Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when the wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad and are, you know, when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face look sad? Or should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed with fire? The king said to me, what is it that you want? I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting next to him, asked me, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy? You can see Nehemiah is a totally different take on things than Ezra, right? Ezra gets a letter from the king, and he's full of faith, and he's happy, and he's off to the races, right? Nehemiah gives the king a list. Can I have letters to the governor so I can have safe travels? Can I have a letter to Asaph so I can get wood for the gates of the temple? Oh, by the way, I need wood for the wall of the city. Oh, and I'm going to need some beams for my house. Nehemiah's going for the gold here. Ezra didn't ask for anything. It's two totally different responses, two totally different levels of faith, two totally different ways of bringing solution, but God's okay with both of them. They both find a way in their own way to bring solution to the Israelites, and the king goes along with it. And it says here, and because the gracious hand of my God was on me, The king granted my requests, just like Ezra. The hand of God was upon me. Remember that. So I went to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. He's got his protection. When Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. They weren't just ticked off that Nehemiah was on his way to rebuild the temple, by the way. They were pretty ticked off at King Artaxerxes at that point for not only allowing him to come, he's got a whole cavalry protecting this guy. They're not happy. So I'm reading this over and over again, and the curiosity is killing me. Why does it say that King Artaxerxes has the queen sitting beside him? I had to find out why it mentions this in the Bible. There's got to be a reason it's mentioned. And in Proverbs 25, it says it's the glory of God to conceal a matter, right? But to search out a matter is the glory of kings. So I'm like, I have got to find this out. Now, when I looked up the word for queen, it's really queen consort, which means it was a queen who still had the title, but who's no longer a ruler. So I started checking the history. And when King Xerxes died and Artaxerxes, his son, took the throne, he still kept his mother in position of the queen by his side. You could look this up for yourself. Every historical reference I found stated most definitely that it was Queen Esther sitting next to her son, King Artaxerxes, when Nehemiah came in. In fact, this would indicate that she was more than likely the one who handpicked Nehemiah, the Jewish prophet, to be the cupbearer to her son. Smart woman. This is the reason why Artaxerxes trusted Nehemiah so much, a Jew. Remember, this is a pagan king, nation that he's serving, just kind of like Daniel serving in Babylon, and it's a pagan king he's serving, just like Daniel serving Nebuchadnezzar. My guess is that Nehemiah, because it says he was in fear when the king said, "What's up with you? Why are you not your usual happy self?" My guess is the only reason he felt comfortable telling him the truth was King Artaxerxes was sitting next to Queen Esther. That's why it says the king who was sitting next to the queen consort. He probably felt comfortable enough to tell him the truth, because by this point, Nehemiah knew Queen Esther was the one in history who stopped the Jews from getting annihilated from Haman. So anyway, you know the story. He lets Nehemiah go to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall, right, with the Israelites. And Nehemiah sets these people up by family, and each has to work on a portion of the wall, staring in the face of their enemies, by the way. And they hit nothing but obstacle after obstacle after obstacle while trying to rebuild it. All the governors in the land were trying desperately to put a fear on him and a fear on the people so they wouldn't be able to build it. They made up lie after lie after lie, and they mocked them to no end. Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. This is a sample of what was going on. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed, and he ridiculed the Jews. And in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they are building, even a fox climbing up on it, could break down their wall of stones." Then verses 7 to 14. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, and the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's wall had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. I'm not even going to touch that one. I think you guys could read in between the lines here. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet the threat. They placed watchmen on the wall who were praying, who were watching and interceding day and night, 24/7. Did that stop the fear? Apparently not, but he kept the watchmen there anyway. Listen to this fear in the next verses. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemy said, "Before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." That sounds like a heck of a lot of fear to me. "Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, their spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who was great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons, your daughter, your wives, and your homes.'" When I read these verses, it really hit home for me. I feel like this is the season that we are in right now. We're in a season where the enemy is deliberately trying to put fear on us. And when you get somebody to live in fear, you control them. There's a fear of disease right now. There's the fear of death. There's fear of authority. There's fear of lack and poverty. There's fear of government. There's fear of violence and riots. There's fear of losing your First Amendment rights. There's fear of losing your Second Amendment rights. There is a fine line between fear and power. A fine line. Because the more power you get, the more people fear you. And the more people fear you, the more power you have over them. It's a cycle. And when you have power over people, you can control them. It's that simple. And I honestly believe that is right where we are in today's culture. This whole culture war, quote unquote, that we're in has nothing to do with what it looks like on the surface. It has nothing to do with gun control and climate change and the pandemic and race and the president. It has everything to do with what the government and the media are trying to control, the way they're trying to control you and I through fear. That's what it has to do with. It's taking control. Look at some of the governors, what they're doing in our country right now to enforce the fact that you can't congregate in churches, even though you can do it in grocery stores, at the MVC lines, right, motor vehicle, in protests. It's all okay, except churches. Talk about being controlled by fear. You guys probably already know this. You can't even worship in California right now because of a disease that the death rate is now down to 0.0002. And they're threatening anyone who disobeys them, not only with these huge fines, they're now threatening them to throw them in jail. Christians have been hit harder than anyone in this season. And if we don't fight back, we're going to lose our freedom to worship one by one. And God's not going to hold them accountable. God's going to hold us accountable if we don't fight. I believe we are in a Nehemiah 4:14 moment. "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." And I feel like right now we really need to take a stand. So what does this all have to do with Esther anyway? We have to understand the incredible influence that she had on her children, apparently, and how that changed history. And if you're like me, you're probably thinking Esther's call in life as Xerxes' wife was to deliver the Jews from a complete genocide by Haman, right? However, after studying this, I come to realize that her call was even bigger than that. Because even after she was no longer the famous queen, her call to be the mother to Artaxerxes, she knew that her son was an inheritance from the Lord with a Jewish upbringing. She knew that from her upbringing from Mordecai. Remember, her parents were killed. That call might have been just as great, if not even greater, than her call to deliver the Jews. Her call to speak into her son's life and influence him in the things of God once again shifted history. We find a king that was ruler over an enormous territory, not only protecting the Jews, think about this, he was commanding every governor in the territory to hand over wealth and provision to them to fulfill God's purposes in the land. During this chaotic, dark time in Israel, where it looked like there was no hope, God caused pagan kings, Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes, in that order, to hear the words of the prophets to stop a genocide and cause Israel once again to flourish even while they were in captivity. And there's one final point that I want to make, and then I'm going to end. And this is where I started on all this, about finding your call in the chaos. We want to do it all, right? I'm sure you guys, you want to feed the poor. We want to evangelize the world. You want to stop sex trafficking. There's so much stuff that has to be done in our world, right? But there's a cross-section. When you have a dream or a passion and you actually get a burden for it, that you have a gift for, that you have a calling to, when it hits your body, your soul, and your spirit, that's how you know it's something you can give yourself to. I love what Dan O'McCollum says. He says, don't just be the idea fairy, be the DNA of God. So what problem should I go after? What solution, what should I find? You don't go after the one that's a passing idea. You go after the one that you can't stop thinking about, the one where the burden doesn't go away. Habakkuk 2:2 says, write it down on tablets of stone so runners can run with it. And that's what Esther did. She got a vision for the Jews after speaking to her uncle Mordecai, and then had her son run with it when she no longer had authority to do it. She didn't have authority in the kingdom of the world, but she had authority in heaven to do it. You have to be able to see it in seed form. Did you ever hear that saying, the tree within the acorn? You have to be able to see it in seed form. After the disciples were filled on the day of Pentecost, right? They're filled with the Spirit. And they say, this is that was prophesied in Joel. How did they know that? They recognized the move of God in seed form. That's how that happened. Nehemiah knew that he was devastated. He had a burden when Jerusalem was in ruin. He couldn't get it out of his mind. And he knew that Jerusalem could not be rebuilt without walls around it. So he went with what he felt he was called to. The wall was Jerusalem restored in seed form. He had to start with the wall. And because he obeyed the call, the irony of it was that God used Israel's armies to pay for it. He caused all those kings, pagan kings, to pay for it. Ezra knew in order to restore temple worship the way God designed it, he had to leave Babylon and go back to Jerusalem. There were lots of priests, but only one that we know of that had the burden to restore worship. Ezra 6 tells us that he asked the king for what he needed, and the king granted everything he needed because God's hand was upon him. Ezra said it, and then the king in his letter stated it. Ezra's burning desire was the fuel that facilitated his call. And if we're listening and we hear and we feel God's heart, if we have a burden for something that just doesn't go away, chances are that's what you're called to in this season. Even if you had one solution from the Lord that you pursue over a lifetime, that transformed just one little piece of society, you will have lived your life with honor. Let's stand up in this chaotic time that we're living in and find our call, find our place. And more importantly, let's live it out. And I'm just going to end by reading one more time, Nehemiah 4:12. I suggest that you guys read this every night, even if it's once a day, whatever. Just read it once every day this week. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who was great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. This is the command of the Lord in the most fearful, chaotic season, one of the most fearful and chaotic seasons that we see in the Bible. That's where we are right now. God doesn't had no intentions of his people to be living in fear. So we're going to make some declarations. You can just repeat them after me. God has given me everything I need to fulfill my call and purpose. I will not live in fear, but will fight for my family and children. I was born for such a time as this.